I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello and welcome to the Raptors Over Everything podcast, presented by KFC. I'm your host, William Liu of Yahoo Sports Canada. On this week's episode, I have features writer Joel Wolfon from The Score.
What is going on?
How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. Embracing the grind and enjoying the NBA season. You know, it's been a good year.
Are you saying that because Norman Powell's back from injury?
Sure. Yeah, let's go with that.
The grinder. Yeah, we'll talk a lot about Norman Powell. And just generally, I think, Wolfon, I mean, even though you cover the general NBA, I know where your heart lies. And it's the Raptors. And, you definitely have a lot of... you're just very insightful when it comes to the Raptors, you know? Definitely a great follow on Twitter and everything like that.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, let's start here, though. Who are the Raptors? Because right now, you have a team that has played pretty much half a season, but you kind of have seen the team sort of fragmented. You have, the full lineup. They played together about half the season. And then you have the no Kyle, no Ibaka team. And then you have the no Pascal, no Mark, no Norman Powell team. And they've all been varying degrees of successful. But I'll just ask you, man, who are the Raptors?
I think that, like, fully healthy, they're still probably like the third or maybe even second best team in the East. Is that crazy to say? Like,
no.
I think if you just look at what they've managed to do while cycling different guys in and out of the lineup, obviously it's just been really difficult to take the measure of the team because either like they've been missing guys or they've been trying to work guys back in. And I think it's just been such a difficult juggling act. But I still have a lot of confidence in this team at full strength. And like the fact that they are still sitting here with the number two defense in the NBA, mm-hmm. obviously the offense has slipped to the point that it's now, I think, below league average. But like, what do you expect when, you know, they missed basically their, you know, their number one offensive option for 11 games. They've been without their starting point guard for 11 games. They've been without their playmaking center for 12 games. And Patrick McCaw is averaging 27 minutes a game. Like, that's to be expected. But I think the fact that they have maintained such an incredibly high defensive baseline mm-hmm. and are now going to start to get these guys back and back into rhythm, I think the ceiling is pretty high. And so I don't know. I think that's who this team is. It's a team that's going to absolutely go and get it at the defensive end every night. I think offense, even fully healthy, is not going to be perfect. It's going to be a struggle some nights. But I think this is a team that, you know, if they had been healthy for the entire season, would probably be top 10 at both ends of the floor. So that's like a borderline elite team, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with pretty much all of that. I think to your point about the team as a whole, the potential is definitely still there in the sense that, like, we've seen the best case scenario from, like, each of these guys individually. Like, for example, like, we've seen, Marcus has just been consistently impactful, but we've seen, for example, in his absence, Serge Ibaka stepped up and he's averaging about 19 points per game with, like, 11 rebounds and shooting 54% from the field. That's awesome production. I mean, you know, it's just the raw numbers are a little bit better than the actual impact numbers, but still. You can't really deny that. Obviously, we've seen Kyle play at an all-star level. We've honestly seen Fred at times play at an all-star level. Pascal has definitely pretty much played at an all-star level throughout the season. And you've seen Norm break out a little bit and find consistency in his scoring. And it's just you've seen all these things. The only thing that is a bit of a question is we haven't seen them all do their best together. Isn't that kind of weird to say? Because just because of the injuries, right? Because, you know, when for example, there was no Kyle Nwabaka, they go 9-2 during that stretch, which is just amazing that they did that. But during that stretch, you know, Fred was balling out, Pascal was balling out. But then when they came back, you know, the production just wasn't quite there. And I guess my question to you is this sort of a question? Is it a fit issue, or is it just sort of like a you know, lack of reps issue because they're just basically dealing with new lineups every day?
I think it's reps. I don't really see a ton of fit issues with this team. Like, I actually think their core pieces complement each other quite well. And, I've thought about this a lot because it's kind of, you know, people are always asking, like, do you think they'll make a move? Like, do they have a trade to make, a clear area that it makes sense to upgrade? And I feel like it's hard to find that move because I think everybody really does sort of fit in their specific role quite well. And there's a lot of just solid complementary talent on this team. So, like, I don't see there being a fit issue at all. Like, I think Kyle and Fred work really well in a backcourt together. I think both of those guys play off of Siakam pretty well. You know, we've seen how well I think everybody plays off of Mark. When Mark's healthy, like, him and Norm have developed a really nice chemistry. And OG being that guy who is, you know, kind of like a secondary attacker off of the catch, who's even able to spot up and hit threes, like at least this season at a 38% clip. I think the pieces all fit pretty well, and there's not a ton of overlap. Like, nobody's really stepping on each other's toes. And I think it's just a question of guys being comfortable, and nobody's really had a chance to get comfortable because everyone's role keeps changing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Fred has had to step in and basically become the primary playmaker when Lowry's been out, and I feel like he's maybe been a little bit overextended in that role at times. He's looked pretty good in that role at times too, but mm-hmm. And then you see, you know, when Siakam and Norm and Mark are all out at the same time, the incredible playmaking load that Lowry has to take on, and that's just not really his game. Like, I don't think he's particularly comfortable having to be a go-to scorer. As much as, you know, in like the Dallas game and the Indiana game, he looked incredibly comfortable doing it. I think ultimately he wants to be more of a facilitator and a playmaker than he does a scorer. So
mm-hmm.
I think guys have been forced out of their comfort zones, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing either. It's given them a chance to, I think, show that at least in spurts they can really do it.
Yeah, that's true. It is really impressive that Kyle can step into whatever role he needs to. Because, like, for a while there, like, he's basically giving you, like, Damian Lillard production. Maybe not the raw scoring wasn't as high as, like, 30 points. But, yeah, Kyle has really worn different hats this year. And I do want to see – I mean, more than anything else, I just want to see the team healthy. Because, I mean, obviously, that's just such a big factor of who's successful in the NBA. But I want to see the team healthy. I want to see them get some reps just so that everyone can sort of find their role, like you mentioned. Because I think right now – it's not necessarily an imbalance, but it does feel a little bit strange that halfway through the season, even after winning the championship, there are still some question marks in terms of exactly how the rotations would shake out. Maybe I'm jumping a little bit ahead here, but in terms of the starting lineup, Nick has mentioned that there might be some changes to, you know, it's up for question. It's up for debate. And, you know, I think it sort of circles back to where they were at the start of the season when they looked at it and they said, well, we have seven guys basically that are starting caliber quality, especially now that Norm Powell has broken out, especially now that OG has really established himself as a quality 3-and-D guy, and Fred has also been really good. Pretty much all there's seven guys on the Raptors that are starting caliber. And I think right now it's really just about finding the fit of that top seven and then sprinkling in like two or three more guys at the back end of the rotation to complement that. So I'll ask you, would you make any changes to starting lineup when everyone gets healthy and hopefully everyone stays healthy?
I don't think I would. I think Mark is ultimately still going to be best in that starting center role, and I still want to see him playing, you know, whatever he was playing before, I think 28 minutes a game.
Yep.
Maybe he gets eased back in, but ultimately, like, I think he is. And if you look at the numbers, like you were mentioning the impact stats on Ibaka, they've been really, really rough this year. And I don't think that has entirely matched my eye test. I think he's been pretty solid for mm-hmm. the most part, but like they've been infinitely better with Gasol on the floor. He has been their most impactful defender. And I think you know, he was starting to come around offensively before he got hurt.
Yeah, he was
starting to actually hit some 2-point shots and score a little bit around the basket. And I still don't think that should be his game at all. Like I've told you before, I think he needs to be shooting like 9 threes a game.
Brook Lopez.
And just migrating out there and essentially taking his playmaking talents out to the perimeter. Like he can make plays outside in just as well as inside out.
Mm-hmm.
And especially the fact that basically nobody's doubling him in the post anymore. There's no real advantage to posting him up or trying to play with him in the interior. But basically, I think he should be the starting center. I think, you know, the other question, I guess, would be about whether Norm or Fred should be the starting two. And as much as, you know, Norm's had a great season, and I do think that he plays better alongside the starters than he does coming off the bench
mm-hmm.
when he has to be more of like an off the dribble threat, which I just don't think is his sweet spot.
He's a finisher. He's not a creator.
Yeah. So I think that's where it gets tough because I think Fred is still quite a bit better than Norm, especially at the defensive end. And so I would prefer to see Fred starting and playing more minutes, but then you get maybe into some stuff where how do you maximize everybody?
Mm-hmm.
And what can you better maximize Norm by having him start and then having Fred come off of the bench and be your primary initiator with transitional lineups? That's where I'm not entirely sure, but I think I'm still lean toward keeping Fred in the starting lineup and bringing Norm off the bench and then maybe just having, you know, one of Fred or Kyle hit the bench like at the 6-minute mark of the first quarter, and then you're still having Norm play with the starters. You're getting him some run with Gasol,
mm-hmm.
and then you're able to stagger Lowry and Van Vliet's minutes, so you're not really playing any with one of those guys on the bench, both of those guys on the bench.
Yeah, yeah, that's ideally you have one of your real point guards on there, so that Pat McCaw is not running point for 20 minutes a game. Yeah, wow, I can't believe they've been running Pat McCaw that much. We'll talk about Pat, I guess, in a bit, too. But yeah, I guess really the starting lineup, it's really just that two-guard spot that people still have questions for. I guess, in my sense, I was always a fan of the Van Vliet and Lowry combo, and I remain that. But I do see the case now for Norm, just because Norm has, I think he has changed his game in a way where he's just so polished as a finisher that I don't mind it, because There are some things you can do with Norm that aren't necessarily there with Fred, but I do ultimately agree with you that Fred brings more to the table, and honestly, there's just more of a track record with Lowry and Van Vliet being successful together. Like Norm, for example, last year, right now, you know, the combination of Lowry and Powell, according to Basketball Reference, the 2-man combination there are about -0.7 points per 100 possessions, so like pretty much like, you know, just league average. Last season it was 1.0, positive 1.0. So again, it's not a great lineup. It's not a bad lineup. It's fine. Whereas if you look at Lowry and Van Vliet this season, it's -0.2 points per 100 possessions. So like marginally better than the Lowry Powell combination. But last season, Lowry and Van Vliet regular season were a +5.2 points per 100 possessions together, and that's not even accounting for the playoffs, where obviously they played a lot together in the finals and even in that Bucks series. So I still ultimately think that's the case. I mean, so, you know, so you get Powell and Ibaka together. I think, you know, that's where some of the fit issues might be, that if you have the starting lineup where it is, and I think the starting lineup is fine, you know, Lowry, Van Vliet, you know, OG, Pascal, Mark. But then ultimately what you're kind of doing is off the bench, you're bringing two finishers and not a guy who can create as well. And I think there's a noticeable drop-off, especially when everyone was healthy at the start of the season. There was a noticeable drop-off when they went to the bench, and the creation just you know, fell off a cliff. Like, Ibaka wants to finish, and Norm Powell wants to finish. And it's sort of just like, who's setting the table for those guys? And that's where I feel like that could be, you know, one of the impetuses, if you were Nick Nurse, to look at maybe slightly different lineup combinations.
Yeah, and I think that's why you want to get Lowry out of the game first, probably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have him run the first 5 or 6 minutes, but like, ideally you want to have him in the game when Ibaka and Norm are there, especially a Serge, right? Like nobody sets the table for Serge better than Kyle does.
Yeah.
And so if you're, you know, bringing Kyle back in to essentially run like, you know, our favorite Kyle and bench look, you know, at the start of the second quarters, then I think you're going to be in pretty good shape.
Yeah.
I think, you know, that's the point I was talking about with the stagger. It's just like, as long as if both those guys are healthy and you're able to play 48 minutes with at least one of Lowry or Van Vliet on the floor, mm-hmm. you know, Van Vliet's not nearly the creator that Lowry is, but I think he's definitely good enough that, you know, if he has to be your primary creator for, you know, however many minutes it is, whether it's like 15 minutes a game, then I think you're okay.
Yeah. And especially if he's out there with Pascal, I feel like he can create.
Yeah.
Not, you don't have to create that much for Pascal. Pascal is just straight up a star and he can create his own offense. But, you know, Van Vliet and Siakam have always had a nice two-man game. And their numbers have always been positive as a tandem. And I feel like that's where, you know, that third playmaker has sort of been of an issue for the Raptors. We're seeing it now. I mean, due to the injuries and stuff like that, that third playmaker is Pat McCaw. And he's had two really good games, you know, against Charlotte and against Boston on the road. But other than that, you know, it's been real rough. And, you know, I guess when everyone's healthy, Pascal really is that third playmaker in the sense where, you know, he can create. And also Mark is also there as a factor, as a fourth. But, you know, if you look at the starting lineup versus the bench, I mean, you have four of your playmakers in the starting lineup and you have pretty much zero on the bench. So that's where I guess the imbalance could come in. But again, like you mentioned, man, you could just stagger the lineup to make sure that it's all there and you can sort of carry those lineups together.
I think Davis too has, like, you know, obviously he has a lot of room to grow as a playmaker, but mm-hmm. like he's got the ability. I think he's a really good passer, and you know, there are some areas I think where his decision making could come a little bit quicker. And a lot of time he's looking for his own offense rather than to create for other people. But like, I think if you give him the chance and give him a few more reps, then he could grow into that role as like a creator off of the bench.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, right now he's more, I mean, he's more Norm than he is Fred at the moment, just in the sense that like he's pretty much playing most of his minutes as a two guard. Functionally, offensively, he is a two guard. You know, by Basketball Reference positional estimates, he's played 8% of his minutes at point guard, 64% at shooting guard, 29% at small forward. I think it's just based on height, to be honest. I think that's actually how they measure that. But still, the playmaking with Terrence, I do want to see some development there. I think this is where, you know, I mean, we'll see him. He's already a little bit too good to play in Summer League. We saw it last year. He kind of dominated Summer League. But just some way for him to get more reps as a point guard. Just because right now, my thing with him is just I see the potential and I want to develop it for sure. But it's sort of right now, he only plays at one speed right now. You know, and he doesn't have that in between, like, yeah, like you come off the high screen, you know, snake the dribble, you know, like let the play develop and then find somebody. He's just right now like zooming through everything. Yeah. And you're not going to – sometimes he's a little bit too fast for a guy like Ibaka to get in position or like, you know, Mark especially, you know?
Yeah, I was just talking about this yesterday actually on the Raptors Republic podcast because I've noticed like when he's – running a pick and roll and going up against a drop coverage, like mm-hmm. there's no in between game. Yeah. And he's got three made field goals this year from 2-point range that are outside the restricted area. So it's like, he's not ever looking to pull up from mid range. He's got no floater game. Mm-hmm. So if he can't get all the way to the basket, it's like, he's usually just pulling the ball back out.
Yeah.
And that's frustrating sometimes because he's not a natural playmaker for other players right now. Like, he's not driving looking to pass necessarily. I think he's driving looking to get all the way to the basket, and if he can't, it's like, oh, he's pulling it back out and like resetting, mm-hmm. as opposed to like, you know, finding a guy with a pocket pass or kicking it out to the corner. So yeah, there's definitely like some kinks to iron out with him, but I think the ability is there, and with a few more reps he's going to get a lot better at that.
Yeah. So would you say he's eighth in the rotation? Obviously the first seven is pretty set. So you got, I guess Norm is kind of the first guard off the bench and Ibaka's the first big. And after that, mm-hmm. you can sort of mix and match. I mean, Terrence is he's pretty much a wing.
Yeah. I mean, I'd be comfortable with him playing, you know, anywhere, like I guess the two or the three. Mm-hmm. He's got pretty decent size and strength. Like, I feel like, obviously like maybe bigger small forwards would give him trouble at the defensive end, but like he's strong, man. I wouldn't have a lot of issues with him guarding most threes. And
he's a really good rebounder, too, for his position.
Yeah.
Yeah.
100%. So, you know, I would say 100% he should be the eighth guy. Okay. I don't know if Nick sees him that way.
Right. Well, Nick's kind of kept him on a, you know, just a shorter leash in the sense that, like, you know, he's been willing to criticize him. And, of course, that became a big story, especially because he has this big redemption game and it's an easy narrative to hop on. But, you know, I just think in general, like, I think Nick sees him as a rookie. And so he gets a little bit less rope than someone like, you know, like Rondé or Pat McCaw, a three-time champion. You know, you can't contain a three-time champion. Yeah. It's just...
McCaw's playing 10.4 more minutes per game than Terrence Davis. Like, I just don't understand it. I know we, like, it's been harped on so much. Mm-hmm. I just can't get over it. Like, why?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. And it's not like Pat is having a down year or whatever. Like, this is exactly what he's been his whole career. Like, if you look at his per 36 numbers, he's averaging 8.3 points this year. His career is 8.6. He's shooting 44% from the field. His career is 4.2. Like, he's shooting slightly better on three-pointers. But it's only 33% from the field. And it's just like, yeah, man, it's just... I don't even know. It's not even like he's like a... It's just like a great playmaker in a way. Like, again, he's had flashes. And if he can make those flashes more consistent, then yeah, he can do some things. But, I mean, just on the whole, he's just so invisible most of the games. And it has been a little strange. It's really been a little strange. But I think Nick just clearly likes Pat McCaw. Like, every Nick Nurse interview every scrum starts with, you know how I feel about Pat McCaw. And I feel like it's almost like a running joke at this point. It's not like McCaw is the Raptors' biggest problems. I think, obviously, McCaw is a limited player, and the Raptors got a lot of injuries, and so they had to extend their rotation, and everyone had to step into an extended role. And McCaw's not the only bench guy that has underperformed. I think Rondé, for example, has had pretty good moments, but also as the season has gone on, I'm just like, every time Rondé comes to the game, I'm like, all right, like, the offense is just going to die, and he's going to miss like three layups that he can make.
Yeah, but I think that has a lot to do with the guys that he's playing with too. Like, early in the season when he was playing great, I feel like, you know, he was playing in lineups that were a little bit more optimal for his skill set. And now,
right,
like, take
the spacing, the floor is just non-existent.
Yeah, and like, I don't think that he and McCaw should ever be on the floor together.
Yeah, that combo is.
I'm looking horrendous. At it now. That two man lineup, him and McCaw together, they have an 88.1 offensive rating and a negative 22 net rating in 150 minutes. Like, that should just never happen.
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, it does speak to how banged up the team is. But, I mean, you know, still, I mean, if you look at some of the Raptors' recent results, like, it's almost directly chalked, you can directly chalk that up to, I mean, just McCaw and Rondé together. I mean, like, damn. I mean, in the Portland game that happened, in the loss that just happened in Toronto.
The Spurs game.
Yeah. It's the same thing. Like, the bench couldn't score. They lost all the momentum. And it's like, the Spurs go on a run. And all of a sudden, the Raptors... You know, they scrapped and fought a little bit at the end and they hit some threes, but ultimately, if the bench doesn't come in and ruin an 18-point lead, like, if you can't trust the bench with an 18-point lead, like, you just can't play them together. That's just kind of what it is, you know?
Yeah, and just as a counterpoint to the Hollis Jefferson and McCaw minutes, Hollis Jefferson and Terrence Davis, almost 400 minutes together this season, right. 109.6 offensive rating, 12.4 net rating, so...
Okay.
You know, play Rondé with guys who can complement his skill set rather than hinder him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll see. We'll see. It's weird because I think Nick has done a really good job in general. And I think on the last Pound the Rock podcast, which I was just listening to when you guys handed out, you and Joey Cash handed out awards, a midseason NBA awards. I think you guys both had Nick Nurse as Coach of the Year.
Like, yeah, we did.
Yeah, he's done an amazing job with the team. It's just one small tiny thing that's just kind of like, why, you know?
Yeah, I can't explain it. Yeah. And when it comes to most things, I've just gotten to a place where I'm willing to kind of trust Nurse implicitly, and just assume that he knows exactly what he's doing, that there's a big picture that he's looking at, that he's seeing, that I'm not, and this is the one that I just can't seem to crack. I can't figure it out.
Yeah, maybe, look, listen, after three seasons and 175 games played, maybe this is when McCaw breaks out, you know? Honestly, it's hard to average 4 points a game on the Warriors. You have so many other threats around you, and you're only scoring four. It's
yeah. Anyway. I mean, 8 points per 36 minutes is pretty remarkable.
That's like, for a guard. Here's the thing: like, it's one thing for like Mark to do something like that, just because like it's just not the same. Like, you have an outsized impact just because like he's outsized. Like, he's like 7 feet tall, and he defends, and he does all these things. And when he does defend, like, it's so much more impactful than when a guard defends. But when you're like, how many point guards in the NBA nowadays are successful who cannot get their own shot? Right? Like, it's like, I mean, a Rondo problem, except he's like way, way, way worse than Rondo.
Yeah. Rondo is like an elite passer, at least.
Yeah.
And can comfortably handle the ball. Like, I don't like watching McCaw dribble. Yeah. It makes me nervous.
Yeah. Well, that concludes the 5 minutes of Pat McCaw slander. It's unfortunate, you know. But, I mean, you know, for the most part, I think, yeah, the Raptors are in a really good spot. They really are. Like, I mean, it's frustrating that they've dropped a couple of games here. You know, I do want to see them get back to a consistency where, like, every under 500 team is a win. And they are competing with all the other top teams. And, you know, Nick Nurse goes. So I think now that Mark is coming back to the lineup, which is confirmed for today's game, in on the road against OKC. We're recording this in the morning right now. I think when Mark comes back, I think, you know, we're going to go back to seeing more of the aggressive defenses. Right now with Ibaka, you can pretty much only play drop because you can, you know, let him protect the basket and get a bunch of rebounds. But I think with Mark in the lineup, I think the IQ of the team changes, especially a lot defensively, and you can see a lot more traps and things like that. So I'm excited to see this team just get into a rhythm. And really, you get into rhythm, you get an easy month. And really, the month of January is pretty easy. The month of February is not that hard either. You coast through all this, and you try to get a bit of a lead in that two spot where the Raptors are currently 2.5 games back of. If they get to the two seed by the All-Star break, I'd be pretty thrilled with where they are.
Yeah. I mean, how could you not be? Those losses where, like, the Portland and San Antonio game especially, like, the Thunder game was tough too, but it wasn't like, you know, they weren't leading by double digits in the fourth quarter of mm-hmm. that game the way that they were against the Blazers and Spurs. Like, those losses really sting, because that's a great opportunity to make up some ground in that race for the two seed with Miami dropping a couple winnable games and the Celtics dropping a couple winnable games. Like, it's just like, you had such a good opportunity to put yourself in just like real like close striking distance as you enter this softer stretch, and like, I think they're still going to have a chance to make up some ground and to get there by the All-Star break, but like, they would have been in really good shape if they'd won those two games.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, on the whole, you go through half a season, you have like three or four disappointing losses. It's not the worst thing. Yeah,
definitely not.
Yeah. Okay, so we're gonna take a quick break right here, and I'm going to give you a message from our sponsor. So, baseball has hot dogs, football has nachos. So, when does basketball get its official food? How about right now? Kentucky Fried Chicken, the official food of basketball. Think about it. Basketball players make buckets all the time. KFC makes buckets all the time. And theirs are filled with fried chicken, like famous original recipe, or crispy popcorn chicken, or even juicy tenders. So, that settles it. KFC, the official food of basketball. Order at KFC.ca. And get it before tip-off. Aside from ordering KFC, we are also going to talk about just this question that I've had. Just because, you know, it's more of a feeling than it is a statistic. Because I think just by advanced metrics, the Raptors' offense has been close to top 10 in crunch time. But it is a bit of a question to me, and just as the eye test, in terms of just like how the Raptors are going to generate baskets when the game gets close, the game gets tight, especially in the fourth quarter. We know the Raptors can defend in those scenarios, so that's good. But how are they going to get offense? And I think this was a theme that sort of played out, you know, a little bit in that Indiana game. That one was more of a defensive issue. I think Kyle was really holding it down for the offense. But definitely that OKC game, and you see it in the Portland game, and now you see it against the Spurs. Wolfon, I mean, I'll just ask you, like, do you see this as an issue, crunch time offense creation?
I mean, maybe more so than last year. You don't have just, like, a stone-cold closer like yeah. Kawhi, who you could give the ball to and just kind of get out of the way and trust that he can go one-on-one and get his own shot against pretty much anybody. But I think like early in the year in crunch time, they were having a lot of success, you know, running the offense through Pascal, whether it was like the Lowry Siakam pick and roll down the stretch of games was really effective.
Yeah.
And I think you can, like, you can invert that pick and roll, right? Like, you can run it with Siakam as a screener, and he got really comfortable on the short roll, either, you know, pulling up from like the free throw line or hitting like a little runner. And if you invert that, like, Lowry's a really good screener. So I feel like he's generally going to be able to make that screen stick, force a switch, and then Siakam essentially going one-on-one against a smaller defender is something that I feel pretty comfortable with.
Yeah.
And even, like you saw in that Spurs game, he had DeRozan on him on that last possession and pretty easily got to that spin move and got a wide-open look at a layup that, you know, 70% of the time, more than 70% of the time, like probably 85% of the time, he's going to hit that layup.
Yeah.
And he just didn't. And whether it was tired legs or whether it was just one of those things where, you know, you're a little bit rushed, you're a little bit anxious, the game is close, like, and you get a bit of the yips, he misses the layup and they lose the game. But, like, you can't be upset with the process in that situation. So I think once Siakam is sort of back up to speed and his conditioning is back and he's feeling fresh down the stretch of games, I think it's going to be fine. Like, he is, again, he's not Kawhi, but I think he's a more than good enough closer that you can feel comfortable essentially running your late game offense through him.
Is it a concern to you at all that his dribble isn't as, his handle isn't as tight as you would normally expect from a closer? Just to, like, you know, in terms of getting his own offense, because he can get his own offense, but I feel like if there's double teams and stuff like that, I'm not as comfortable with him having the ball as I would be, for example, with a Kawhi or with a Kyrie or, you know, LeBron or Steph or, you know, James Harden, you know, these kind of guys.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And I think that's why, you know, for the most part, teams do run their late game offense through guards, or at least, you know, primary playmakers. Like, I guess LeBron isn't a guard, but like you put the ball in the hands of a guy who is creating shots, whether for himself or other people. And that's been like sort of the big problem with Philadelphia, right? Like, they don't have that guy who they can give the ball to, who has a tight enough handle to get their own shot, to break down a defense off the bounce. And, you know, they're sort of relegated to having to run their late game offense out of the post. And Embiid has struggled with turnovers, and he's not the greatest passer out of double teams, although I think, you know, he's gotten better on that front. Like, he can draw fouls and things like that.
Right.
And Siakam's sort of somewhere in the middle where he can handle the ball pretty well. There are certain guys, like, you know, plotting big men, I suppose, that he can easily take off the bounce, and smaller guys that he can take into the post. He's not a dominant post force the way that Embiid is, and he's not a dominant off the dribble force like, you know, some of the guys like Kawhi and Kyrie that you mentioned. So yeah, he falls somewhere in the middle on both of those fronts, and you kind of just got to make the most of it. But I think the good thing is he's not, you know, he's not their closer to the extent that it's like every single possession, like, they're just clearing out for him.
Yeah.
And they have, like, other high-end creators that they can involve in their late-game sets to make that a little bit easier on them, whether it's Lowry, whether it's Van Vliet. They love to run that hammer play out of timeouts to get those corner threes. It seems to work. Like, I don't know how it works out as often as it does, but they almost always get a clean look out of that set.
Yeah. I think it helps to have – they can run that for either Fred or Kyle, so it's a little more unpredictable. But still, yeah, it does work an amazing amount of times.
So, you know, I think that's fine. You know, I think it's fine to kind of close by committee.
Yeah.
When you don't have one of those ace, you know, ball handling closers. And I think because there is enough surrounding and complementary ball handling, you can feel pretty comfortable putting it in just about anybody's hands and expecting them to make a play.
Yeah, that's true. And there's something to be said about being more unpredictable and a little bit more flexible in terms of just, like, you know, defenses can't load up. coming out of a timeout. You're not exactly sure what the other team's going to run. You can't set up your defense specific against one guy. And, of course, if that guy is cold, then it's not like your whole team is cold. Mm-hmm. But I guess, you know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking about the score's tied 90-90 in Game 7, and there's 4.2 seconds left on the clock, and you got to get a shot. I'm thinking about that scenario, and I think that's where not having the, just like the big wing who can dribble and shoot out, and just shoot out the dribble consistently, it does worry me a little bit. But then again, I don't know, man. Pascal, you've kind of seen it all season. Like, he's taking some lesser efficient shots in the sense that, like, you don't want to see him go hunting for shots that often in the mid-range. But I also think if you look at the bigger picture, I think he is taking those shots with a specific goal in mind of just, he's going to have to eventually take that shot. And I guess, you know, if it, again, came down to Game 7 and there's 4 seconds left on the clock, the Raptors have the ball in the front court to inbound, they're probably giving that ball to Siakam, and he's probably got to, you know, make one or two, maybe probably at most two dribble moves and shooting it. And he needs to get consistent with that shot. And
he also needs guys to guard him out there.
That's true.
You know, that's true. If, like, the more that shot becomes a legitimate threat, the easier it's going to be for him to get all the way to the basket. Like, you know, we saw what he ran into in the playoffs last year when the teams that are, you know, sticking big guys on him, essentially daring him to shoot. And if he's not willing to do so or not able to knock those shots down, then they're just waiting for him under the basket. But if guys actually have to come and take that shot seriously, that's going to just open everything up for him. And I think we've seen a lot of that this season. But the jumper has sort of fallen off, I think, from where it was at the start of the year.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, he's also had some tired legs. He's had some weird games where it's just he can definitely shoot, and he actually makes him in a pretty respectable clip. It's just like, I don't know. I mean, the one, it's like, how many shots do you trust him to shoot right now? I mean, I definitely trust him to shoot the corner three. He's very good at that. But when it's like top of the key and stuff like that, even though he has improved and his numbers are dramatically different than when they were last year, I'm not trying to like underplay the development here. But it reminds me of when Nick Nurse said at practice like a couple months ago. He's just like, look, man, Pascal's improved a lot, but he's probably like 12 to 18 months away from his just like being fully arrived as a shooter. And we are still kind of watching him at a development point as compared to the finished product. But, yeah, I mean, there's just some erratic misses from him, you know, where you're just like, what?
I was talking to a friend about this recently, and we were sort of commenting on the fact that it seemed like early in the season he was making that, like, one-legged fadeaway with a lot of regularity. Like, it seemed like that shot was just going to be money for him, and I kind of can't remember the last time he's made that shot. I feel like he's maybe just lost the touch on that particular jumper.
Yeah.
But on the, like, really encouraging side of the ledger, so last year he took 63 above the break threes.
Yeah.
And he hit 27% of them.
Yeah.
And this year already he's shot 133 above the break threes, and he's shooting 39%. He's shooting better above the break than from the corners.
That's wild.
And and he's taking three times as many threes above the break as he is from the corners. So I think for one thing that speaks to like his changing role. Mm-hmm. Like, he's not spotting up anymore. He's the guy who has the ball in his hands.
Yeah.
And typically those guys shoot above the break. They don't shoot in the corners. You don't really handle the ball in the corner ever. So he's completely inverted his three-point shot profile to the point that he's now both taking way, way more of his shots above the break and actually hitting them in a better clip than he is from the corner. So
it's weird, though. As a feel thing, it always feels – I'm always like, yeah, he shoots a corner three, it's going in. And then when it's above the break and off the dribble, it's not there. But then also there's been a lot of games where he's just been red hot and closed out games like that. You know, like he did that to the Pistons a couple of times. And in that game where he hurt his groin or whatever, he still hit two more threes after that to close out that game, which is pretty great. I mean, as a whole, I don't know, man. It's a sort of an open question for me. I'm not saying it's necessarily a huge fundamental weakness, but it is something that I'd like to see answered as the year goes on. I'd like to see more Pascal in that role, and I'd just like to see like if there's some sort of consistency in terms of how the Raptors are going to run that offense, because I think we kind of agree that like Kyle was not really that guy to always get you a bucket. He can definitely make a lot of plays in crunch time, but he's not really the guy I want taking the last shot. And maybe it's just having seen the last shot, you know, against Indiana and a couple of these games here where they've needed some offense and he hasn't really delivered that shot. But I mean, still, I think just historically, it's hard for a 6'4" guard to get a great shot at that moment.
Yeah. Unless you're Chris Paul, in that Indiana game, Chris Paul, absolutely. Seriously. Killing it. Well, that's where it really helps to just have that money mid-range game, right? Yeah. Like, that's a shot that, like, if you can get to it reliably, like, it's kind of always going to be there, because, like, a defense just, like, they can't take away everything. And I feel like late in the game, if you can just create a little bit of separation, mm-hmm. like, that's why Kawhi was so effective. Because he could get to that spot and just rise up, and nobody could really bother his shot from like 15 feet. And that's just not really Kyle's game. But, you know, in that Indiana game, like, he got a great look out of that hammer action. Yeah. Pretty much a wide open corner three.
Yeah.
And unfortunately just wasn't able to knock it down. But, like, that's a shot that I will live with him getting and taking 10 times out of 10, especially given that he'd had such an unbelievable game up to that point.
Right.
I'm comfortable with Kyle Lowry taking a wide open corner three to tie a game. Like, I think that's fine. And again, good process, just didn't get the result that they needed.
Yeah. All right. Well, if we take a look beyond this season, I do have some long-term questions that I hope to have answered in sort of the second half of the year and the playoffs and beyond. First off, who is the starting center next year? Not a lot of bigs in the pipeline.
Yeah, I mean, in an ideal world, I would just love to see them bring back Mark on a one-year deal.
Mm.
Like, that would be perfect. Give him $20 million. I don't care. Like, yep. Do you think that's enough to bring him back for 1 year?
Yeah, 20. Yeah, definitely.
I
think he likes the situation, like, too, so that helps.
Yeah, and then it's like, you know, maybe, like, I don't know if he could make up that kind of money on the open market. Like, I don't think a team is even going to give him, like, 2 years, $25 million. So I think if they were to get, like, willing to give him 1 year, 20, then that would be enough to lock him in for another year. That's my feeling, and I think that would be my first choice. I don't see Ibaka being back as much as that saddens me. I feel like by next year, Boucher will probably be ready to be like the full-time backup center. And I think you could maybe live with that. But yeah, like, it's not like they're not going to sign Andre Drummond, like, nor should they. They're not going to sign anybody that's going to compromise their long-term cap space.
Yeah.
So to do, you know, like a kind of a Kyle Lowry type deal where you're giving them like a balloon payment in exchange for getting the shorter term. I feel like they would probably try and do that. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's probably the most ideal one. There is a bit of a question to me as to which one to sign in terms of like Serge or Mark. I mean, if they both want to come back on 1 year deals, I'm fine with that too, actually. But
yeah,
I doubt that, especially in the case of Serge. I think Serge is in well positioned to get another multi-year contract at a pretty hefty price, and he deserves that. Honestly, he's played really well, and he's really taken care of his body. He's developed his game a little bit too. He's shown a lot of I can't believe, I remember when we were at the Score and you wrote that piece about Serge Ibaka. This is before the 2018 playoffs, and one of the quotes in there was Serge is like, "Hey man, you can count on me, all right? In the playoffs, I'm gonna step up." And then all my memories of Serge in the 2018 playoffs are him getting stripped by Kyle Korver.
Oh my God, he couldn't dribble past half court. But you remember how that playoff started for him? He had an unbelievable game one against the Wizards.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, playoff Ibaka, it is on. Yeah.
We were yelling playoff Ibaka at each other in the basement of Doc Ellis.
Yeah. But no, I talked to him for that story, and he was so just like full of confidence. And he was like, yeah, don't worry about it. Like, and I'm thinking, like, this guy has been part of some of the most intense Western Conference playoff series that we've ever seen. Like, he's not, like, he'll be fine. Mm-hmm. He's not going to get shook. He's been there before. He knows how to sort of pace himself. And come playoff time, he's going to be a beast. And then he really, really wasn't. But credit to him for coming back last year and just being pretty much perfect in his role.
I was going
to
say, man, he, I was just, the development from his perspective is it's just impressive for an older guy to increase his skill set like that. And he's so much more polished now than when he first came to Toronto. So big credit to Serge. I think, yeah, he's probably going to have a multi-year deal. So I think that one's a little bit less realistic in terms of the Raptors re-signing on a one-year deal to preserve the cap. And I think Mark, he probably likes it here, man.
You know, yeah. Why wouldn't he? Yeah. He's in a great situation to kind of play out the twilight of his career.
That's true. It's a winning organization. There's, I guess, good Spanish restaurants in Toronto.
Yeah, there's good everything restaurants in Toronto.
That's true. There is good everything restaurants. He's a worldly man. I agree. I think Mark's there. The Boucher long term, I mean, I want to do question a little bit just because I'm still not fully convinced that Boucher is. Well, he's better than Bebe, but it could be a Bebe type of situation where, like, he's productive and useful, but also maybe a little bit fundamentally flawed. I think his mentality is definitely better than Bebe's in the sense that, like, it's just he's more focused on the game. On a game-to-game basis, this is less, like, mental slip-ups from Boucher. But, I mean, I don't know. He's also 27. This is sort of the peak of his athleticism. Yeah. He's definitely productive, and he's definitely deserves to be in the NBA and, you know, has contributed to a winning team. He's shown that this year. But even as, like, he's a full-time backup, I'm still a little bit leery about it, you know?
He's way more explosive than Bebe. He's way faster than Bebe.
Yeah.
And he's just more even-keeled, too, right? Like, Bebe was, like, he'd have wild swings, and, like, he was sort of notoriously moody, would get really down on himself. And there was just a lot more volatility there, where I feel like with Boucher, he's been pretty steady.
Mm-hmm.
And, I just think, like, maybe he's prone to the same kind of slip-ups. Like, he still hasn't quite nailed down, like, the intricacies of NBA defense, and he's very jumpy.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to rebounding, like, he often just kind of tries to jump for the ball rather than boxing out. Like, he maybe gets a little bit over-exuberant.
Any
jumping for blocks when he doesn't need to, like, gets pump faked off his feet, but like his recovery speed,
yeah,
like
it's insane. And I think he might lead the league in block 3-point shots. I don't know where to find numbers on this.
On a per minute basis, he's probably pretty close. It's like him and Mitchell Robinson, I would think.
It has to be, yeah, exactly those two. And I think apparently Tatum is also pretty high up there too this year.
Oh really?
Yeah, and last year he was among the league leaders. But like, it's surprising. Like the league leader in 3-point shots usually is. You don't really see even double digits that often. And mm-hmm. I feel like Boucher has already gone to double digits in terms of 3-point blocks. He's maybe in that Dallas Mavericks game alone, that comeback, I think he blocked like two. So
yeah. And then you add in just like the shooters that he spooks when like he's closing out or when he's in the vicinity and deters him from even taking those shots in the first place. Like he, yeah. I think it's a nice luxury having him as essentially your third big man. Honestly, like just watching him this season, I would have faith in him being like a full-time backup. I think he's good enough. And I think within the Raptors' sort of hyper-aggressive scheme, like he is really effective because A, he's a very good trapper, and mm-hmm. B, he's fast enough to sort of recover and get back into position and make their back-end scrambles work. So
yeah. And he's not even that bad of a defensive rebounder, even though he's just like mad skinny or whatever. Like the hustle and the length is there.
Makes sort up of for a lot.
Yeah, I mean, his defensive rebounding rate for his career is 21%, and really his career is like the last 2 years. It's not bad. 21% is not bad. It's probably better than Mark's, to be honest. It's definitely not like 30% like JV, but still. Clearly different players. Okay, that's one of my long-term questions. By the way, long-term question, has Norman Powell played himself into being an asset? So we've talked a long time about Norman Powell signing this contract and then being disappointing on the contract. But this season, if you look at the numbers and you look at the production that he's had, and also just the improvement that he's made, you can make the point that Norman Powell might actually now be an asset on his contract. First off, I mean, let me just give you the numbers. Norman Powell's averaging 14.6 points per game, 3.9 rebounds, 1.8 assists. I can't believe that's almost two. That's kind of impressive. I thought it was going to be one for sure. And then 1.1 steals. He's shooting 50% from the field, 49.7. He's shooting 40% from three. You know, he's getting to the free throw line. Not a lot, but definitely more than last season. And he's shooting 83% from there. As a starter, those numbers are even better. You know, if you look at just the starts this year, and even last year as a starter, he was okay. But this year especially, 17.2 points as a starter, 2.2 assists, 3.8 rebounds. The offensive rating, 119 with him on the floor, and defensive rating, 106. Like, that's pretty damn good. And he's only really getting good. Paid like about $10 million a year. At this point, would you say he's an asset, or would you, or do you still kind of look at it as a question mark?
I think he's probably pretty close to neutral value on that contract, maybe slightly above.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like a lot of encouraging signs. I mean, the fact that he's shooting 40% from three for the second year in a row.
Yeah.
And is up around 60% true shooting for the second year in a row. He's actually at 62% true shooting. That is crazy. And probably most encouraging of all is like shooting 69% in the restricted area.
Mm-hmm.
Like, remember, like he had a lot of trouble
in
the past finishing around the rim, and like
way too
fast. He's just been dynamite as a finisher this year. So
yeah,
I think maybe like slightly above neutral value, to the point that like if the Raptors were like looking to make an upgrade, if you attach, I feel like the Raptors first rounder this year isn't super valuable, both because it's going to be in the 20s and everyone seems really down on this draft class. But
yeah,
if you like attach the first rounder to Norm, I feel like that's a pretty good trade package that might be able to get you a solid upgrade.
Yeah. And you know, the weird thing with, in terms of upgrade, just like in trading Norm and upgrading from Norm, I just wanted like good Norm consistently. And like good Norm has been consistent for like, I mean, okay, obviously there's an injury in between, but it was good against the Spurs. And before that, it was like 3 weeks straight of consistency. And whatever, I mean, maybe you want a whole season worth of consistency instead of just 3 weeks. But, you know, it's been eye opening, man. He's really made improvements. I'm really happy for Norm. This doesn't mean he gets traded, but still.
Yeah, I mean, it would be sad if, like, after all that work, like, to turn himself into a productive player, it like, all that earned him was a trade to Sacramento or something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, God. But...
you want Bojan? Like or Bogdan?
Yeah, I do, actually.
Yeah, he would be really nice. In terms of, oh, my God, as he'd be, like, what, the fourth playmaker? Maybe third? But, yeah.
It'd be nice.
We'd have five legitimate playmakers. It'd be very nice. Yeah.
And even, I think there's a couple different ways I could go with that. Mm-hmm. Assuming that teams around the league would actually value that, say, Powell in the first package, the way that I am seeming to value it.
Yeah.
I don't know if that would be enough to get bogged in, but you could go in that direction where you're looking to get like another sort of tweener, like scorer slash playmaker.
Yeah.
Whether that's Bogdanovich or like a Evan Fournier type.
Yeah.
And then there's also the thought of maybe trying to get somebody like Covington, who's just giving you more at the defensive end of the floor. Like Norm's defense really hit or miss. I think on the ball he's pretty solid, but off ball he spaces out a lot.
Yeah.
And Covington is like one of the best wing help defenders in the league and has become like a really reliable 3-point shooter, so I feel like that would be a pretty nice upgrade as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that one, I mean, actually, Assad slid into the mentions and asked me that yesterday. I think ultimately I trust Covington a little bit more than Norm, so I said yes, but it's weird. If fit-wise, I don't think it's the best. Yeah, okay. But I think ultimately it has to be at least neutral at this point. Because yeah, it's also so. Like the contract is just really... like cheap. It's like $10 million. It's 11 next year. It's a player option for 12 in 2021. You know, I'm no longer looking at it like, man, the Raptors need to get this, not get this contract off the books, but it's sort of it's a hindrance to what they might want to do. I'm looking at it almost as like it's a tradable contract. It's a good number. And the production is good. So it's an asset. I mean, I don't know what else you really want. Out of that, okay, the third long-term question and the last one is, OG Anunoby a core piece or a trade piece?
I think he's a core piece. Okay. I mean, would you say otherwise? Like I've not really thought about it, I guess, but I've always considered him a core piece. He's still only, what is he, 22?
22,
and,
yeah.
And I think, you know, maybe a little bit of the shine has come off after the start of the season when it looked like he was just going to be an absolute stud. Like his offensive game, and I still think he's made meaningful improvements offensively. But like he was, you know, through the first month of the season, like one of the very small handful of like the absolute best defenders in the NBA. I don't think he's been quite that good since then, but I still think he's been spectacular defensively. And to see him at least being willing to take guys off of the dribble, he's, you know, had a couple of flashes where he's like shooting off of screens and pulling up a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't think he's never going to be an offensive star. Like, he's never going to be a guy who's like running pick and roll, shooting threes off the dribble. Like, that's just not going to be his game. But I think his upside is still elite role player. And I feel like as a guy to, you know, pair with Siakam and presumably Van Vliet and maybe, you know, a free agent signing or two.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a guy that you want to have around. And now obviously, like, you know, nothing's ever totally off the table. Like, if the right trade comes around where you see a chance to get a superstar and it means parting with OG, it's not like I'm opposed to that. But if I'm looking at it now, I definitely see him more as a long-term piece than a trade chip. Do you feel otherwise?
No, I feel the same as you. I'm kind of asking this question because other people have asked the question. I don't know. It's like a OG's like a marshmallow, the marshmallow test. Like, do you want to trade him now for Gallinari, or do you want to wait to have him grow and get, I don't know.
To trade him for two Gallinaris later?
Yeah, that's why they call it the marshmallow test. No, but, I mean, it's just, yeah, I'm looking at it like, if you had reasonable expectations from OG and didn't think of him as the next Kawhi Leonard or whatever, then I think you'd be pretty, I think reasonable minds can agree that he's made tangible improvements across the board. The three-point shooting has definitely bounced back from where it was last year. He's playing more of his own. It seems like he's more of a three than a four. Last year, he played a lot of minutes as a four. Just not as effective in that role. Even though there's not that big of a difference, I just think that, like, when he's out there with a power forward like Pascal, and just the fit in the starting lineup, as you mentioned, it just works really great. And I think a lot of his production tailing off is just a reflection of injuries, to be honest. If a guy can't create his own offense and there's a lot less playmakers on the floor, he's not going to be as successful. But you look at it, the field goal percentage is 49.6%. He's shooting 38% from three. The free throw percentage, for some odd reason, is low. And for a while in the season, he was shooting like in the 30s, but it's rebounded. The rebounding has been a really nice uptick because, especially in a long-term fit with a long guy like Pascal, I think you do want a plus rebounder at that position just because Pascal's not necessarily the greatest rebounder for a power forward. Now, granted, nowadays everyone's smaller. You know, it's fine, but still, OG's definitely stepped up in terms of the rebounding. The assists are up, and then he's also just still creating a lot of havoc on defense. And so when you put that all together, it's like for a 22-year-old who you have his restricted rights after the season, or after next season, it just, I think it probably makes more sense to hold on to OG. Because if you trade OG, you're immediately looking for another OG and Anunoby to fill that slot.
Right.
And the Raptors have had so much instability at small forward, just historically as a franchise, that, yeah, OG is, he's kind of a godsend. He really brought stability to that position, even back in 2017-18 when he was a rookie and he won it over Norm Powell, who just straight up isn't a small forward. But, yeah, I mean, it's been great. I mean, obviously they got Kawhi in between that, and, you know, he was a lot of stability at small forward. But yeah, I mean, long term wise, I think I'm pretty comfortable with where OG is, and I think it's really just like, can a guy develop handles to a point where it can allow him to connect more parts of his game? And I don't know where you stand on that, because, you know, I think we can all agree 3-point shooting is something that can be developed. Is developing handles, and even just, not even just handles, but like the mentality to and the confidence to attack a defense, is that something that can be developed?
I think it certainly can be. I think what happened with Kawhi sort of spoiled people to the point where they're looking at OG as a rookie and as, you know, a guy who basically fit that prototype, who came ready-made with the body and the defensive skill set and the IQ, but needed to fill out the rest of his game. And it's just like, Kawhi was like a needle in a haystack. Like, you just, you know, we might never see anything like that again in terms of his skill development. And I guess Pascal too is like spoiled people in the sense that it's like, well, look at the leap that this guy made. And like, when is the Pascal like leap coming for OG? And it's just something like that is never likely. I'm not saying it's impossible, and I wouldn't even say that it's totally off the table, but like, I think it's very unlikely. but that doesn't mean that he can't still grow in those areas. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he has grown in, you know, what's now his third season, and his second season was basically like a lost year anyway, so yeah. It's almost like this is his second season, and he's already, you know, showing some development as a guy who, like, it's not just straight line drives, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we knew, like, he could, you know, attack a closeout, put the ball on the floor, like, he was explosive, he could get to the rim, he was a great cutter, but the thing that's really encouraged me is, like, he's shown some ability to attack in a little bit more of, like, a roundabout way, where he's moving somewhat horizontally.
Yeah.
And even if it's not just straight attacking a closeout and blowing by guys, like, he's strong enough where it's, like, he can take a guy to the basket, and he does that kind of like jump stop where he's dipping his shoulder into a guy and knocking him back just far enough to get that layup up and in. Like,
yeah,
stuff like that has all been encouraging. And even if it's like a little bit more incremental than it looked like it might be at the start of the season, I'm still very optimistic about the kind of player he can be moving forward. And I don't think the Raptors are close enough to winning a championship this season to compromise that for a shorter term upgrade.
Yep. And if you were even to trade him for something like that, then I would need a small forward coming back, man.
Yeah.
There's just not a lot of small forwards that you can plug into this team. It's just, you know, OG's, he fits the starting lineup really well. Okay, that does it for the long-term questions. That mostly does for the podcast as well, unless you want to talk about this recent report from Ramona Shelburne that Drake allowed Paul George and Kawhi to rent his house.
I really don't.
Yeah. I don't care, man. This is the thing. I don't care. He's gone. All the details. It's like, I don't know, man. Someone breaks up with you, and then like 6 months later, someone gives you like a whole bunch of details. I'm like, I don't care. It is what it is. It's over. I can't do anything about it.
And, you know, whatever. Whether they were meeting at Drake's house or somewhere else, it's not like that conversation wasn't going to happen.
They could have called each other on the phone. Like, you could have done a lot of things.
Yeah, and it just seems like Kawhi was going to find his way to L.A. one way or another, you know? Like, it really does seem that way. And I don't know. I'm over it. I've been over it for a while. And so I just hope he's happy. I hope he's happy with his decision. I hope he's happy playing at home and getting to spend more time with his family. Like, those are the reasons he wanted to go back. So I hope that it's working out well for him.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, obviously, we missed a guy. But
yeah,
it's not. I don't know. You can also, there's a piece in the sense that you can live with the fact that he left because it's entirely on him, because the Raptors did everything possible to convince him to come back. So I don't really care if, like, I don't know, man. You think what? If also, what was Drake supposed to do? Like, he was supposed to just like stand outside the door and just like keep his ear and to the door into the basement where they're discussing it. And then Paul George is like, yeah, you know, I want to let's go to the Clippers. And Drake's supposed to just storm through like the Kool-Aid man. And I don't know. Like, what are we supposed to do, man? Like, it's just whatever.
What a
story.
I didn't even read the story, honestly. Like, I just saw the kind of tidbit floating around on Twitter.
Yeah.
So I don't know like all the details, but Yeah, I can't be bothered to care.
You're not firing the global ambassador based on this?
No, I think, I mean, whatever. Is that still like his title? Does he still have that role with the team? I feel like he's maybe not.
No, he still
seems
is.
More like, yeah?
Yeah.
What does that role really involve? Like, does he have a job description?
No, he's basically just a famous fan.
Yeah, like, he's a glorified
fan. He's, like, I mean, I guess Jimmy Goldstein doesn't really have one particular team, but, like, yeah, he's not Vache with actual clout.
Is he on the payroll? Like, they're paying him to be, like, a glorified fan? I mean, I guess they have, like, all this.
I think Drake pays more to the Raptors than the Raptors pay Drake, personally.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, like, between the naming rights to the practice facility and...
But that's like a business deal. Like, it's fine. I mean, you know. But yeah, I mean, I think Drake supports basketball. He supports Canadian basketball for sure. He supports basketball with the Raptors. And I don't know, man. I just like this arrest Drake stuff. This is for Milwaukee fans to to indulge in. I just can't. I really can't. It just, it's such a stupid thing, man.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, ultimately, like, yeah, over the years, the partnership has been, has provided more good than bad. So I don't think it's worth relitigating now.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, Joey. What have you been working on? What should people read? You know, give a little short blurb for Pound the Rock.
Pound the Rock is the Scores NBA podcast. I host it with Joseph Cacciaro. And Will, you recently came on for our 100th episode.
Yeah.
A big milestone for us. And
for sure.
You were obviously with us from the start and helped us get it off the ground. So it's great to have you back on to talk about the Raps. But most of the time on the show, we just talk about the NBA generally, bounce around the league.
Mm-hmm.
And we hit on a lot of Raptors stuff, but it's more just like in the context of the NBA as a whole. But
yeah,
we put that out once a week. And I'm also writing, you know, two, sometimes three features a week at the Score, Score app, the Score website.
Yeah.
Score
bet. About... Come on, man. Get that stock up, man.
Yeah.
Seriously, we got homes to buy.
The Score bet is active, I think, in New Jersey only right now.
It doesn't matter, baby. The stock is going
possibly
up.
Possibly coming to a state near you.
Okay.
Sometime soon. So I write about all things NBA. I wrote about LaMarcus Aldridge's three-point shooting. That was the most recent thing I put out. I'm working on a Grizzlies feature right now.
Nice.
And
I feel like you would love the Grizzlies. I mean, the Grizzlies are just very, very fun to watch this year.
They've been, like, probably my single favorite non-Raptors team to watch this season.
Are they
like
your new Pacers?
The Pacers is different for me. Like, the Pacers have never been an especially, like, exciting team to watch. It's not like I watch the Pacers and I'm like, oh, man, this is, like...
I can't wait to see what TJ Warren does next.
This is high-octane basketball. I just, for whatever reason, like, a couple years ago, the first Oladipo season, I became very attached to that team.
Yeah, yeah.
I've always, like, had a thing for Nate McMillan teams, weirdly.
Okay.
Like,
that's a weird...
I was a huge fan. I was a huge fan of those Sonics teams. A huge fan of those Blazers teams.
Yeah.
And I honestly couldn't even tell you why. I just think, like, he always has his teams prepared. They play really hard.
For sure.
They play really smart. So the Pacers are, like, a completely different thing from the Grizzlies, who are just, like, play above the rim and, like, they're fast, they're athletic, and are just, like, so far ahead of schedule. And I think when everything sort of comes together like that and you see, like, the present and the future collide, it's always really exciting. So writing about them, and I have some other stuff in the works, some longer term reported features that I'm excited to put out in the next few weeks. So you can keep an eye out for those, and give me a follow at Joey_W.
Yeah, there you go. So yeah, and also, man, Pound the Rock forever, really. It's a mentality. Even though Dwayne Casey has moved on to coaching and lying about Seiko Demboya, you know, it's Pound the Rock is forever. And also, it's just as an NBA pod, you guys, it's not, you know what it is? Most NBA pods this year, I swear to God, I've heard so much Lakers, Clippers, not even the Celtics. I honestly wouldn't even mind more Celtics coverage just because I feel like it's an underreported team this year. Just in the context of just there's so much freaking Lakers and Clippers. And I guess Sixer drama, whatever, which it's whatever. Not that interesting to me, honestly. But I mean, like, yeah, you guys actually cover like all the whole league. Like, you have a whole episode, the Jazz and Nuggets are rolling. You know what I mean? And then right after that, Blake Griffin surgery and trade ideas for Andre Drummond. And, you know, there's talks about the Knicks and the Raptors and you know, it just, you know, there's just a lot. The Heat got a lot of coverage from you guys. And Cash seems to really be head over heels for the Heat.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the Heat are Cash's Pacers.
Yeah, apparently. So, yeah, there you go. So, listen to Pound the Rock. Follow Joey _W. Follow Joe Wolf on. Read everything he writes. The absolute must read. And yeah, as for the podcast, thanks everyone for listening. Big thanks to KFC for sponsoring the show. And I'll be back later today, I guess, to recap the Raptors. Hopefully a win over OKC. I mean, OKC is playing well, but with the Raptors getting more healthy, I do want to see them get some of these. And it would be a very nice win if they won an OKC tonight. So we'll speak then.
Hey, Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.